the founding of Gordias, elements of the story can move from myth to legend to actual identifiable history. In Macedonia, there lived a poor but ambitious peasant called Gordias. One day, as he labored in his barren, stony fields, an eagle landed on the pole of his ox cart and fixed him with a fierce glare. "I knew it," Gordias said to himself. "I have always felt that I was marked for greatness. This eagle proves it. I have a destiny." He raised his plough and drove the oxen cart many hundreds of miles towards the oracle of Zeus Sabazios. Sabazios was a horse-riding incarnation of Zeus, worshipped by the Thracians and Phrygians. As he lumbered along, the eagle gripped the pole fast with its talons, never flinching, no matter how violently the cart bumped and swayed over the potholes and boulders. On the way, Gordias encountered a young Telmisian girl, endowed in equal measure with great prophetic powers and an alluring beauty that stirred his heart. She seemed to have been expecting him and urged that they make haste at once to Telmissus, where he should sacrifice his ox to Zeus Sabazios. Gordias, fired by the coming together of all his hopes, undertook to follow her advice so long as she agreed to marry him. She bowed her head in assent, and they set off for the city. It so happened that at this very moment the king of Phrygia had just died in his bed. Since he left no heir or obvious successor, the people of his kingdom hurried to the shrine of Zeus Sabazios to find out what should be done. The oracle told them to anoint and crown the first man to enter the city in a cart. So it was that the townspeople were clustering excitedly round the gates at the very moment that Gordias and the prophetess arrived. The eagle flew from his perch with a great cry as they crossed the threshold. The populace threw their caps in the air and cheered until they were hoarse. In a very short time, Gordias had gone from scratching a lonely living in the Macedonian dirt to being wed to a beautiful Telmisian seer and crowned king of Phrygia. He drew up plans to rebuild the city, which he immodestly named Gordium in his own honour, and settled down to reign over Phrygia and live happily ever after. Which he did. Sometimes, even in the world of Greek mythology, things go well. The ox cart became a holy relic, a symbol of Gordias's divine right to rule. A carved post of polished dogwood was placed in the agora, and the yoke of the cart secured to it with rope tied up in the most intricate knot the world had seen. Gordias was determined that the cart should never be stolen from the town square. The legend arose, in that mysterious and unattributable way that legends do arise, that whoever untied this fiendish knot would one day rule Asia. Many tried, master mariners, mathematicians, toy makers, artists, artisans, tricksters, philosophers, and ambitious children, but none could even begin to unpick its elaborate interweaving hitches, loops, and twists. The great Gordian knot lay unsolved for more than 1,000 years, until a reckless and brilliant young Macedonian conqueror and king, called Alexander, rode with his army into town. When told of the legend, he took one look at the great tangle of rope, raised his sword, and swept it down, cutting the Gordian knot and earning the delighted praise of his own and future generations. When I first heard this story, I thought not more of Alexander, but less. He cheated, I said. Suppose I solved a randomized Rubik's Cube by jemmying it open with a screwdriver until all the pieces fell out, and then pressing them back again in the right order. Who would praise that? But Alexander is congratulated by history for thinking outside the box, and called the Great. One rule for the genius warrior kings of the world, and another for the rest of us. Meanwhile, back in time, Gordias's son, Prince Midas, grew up to be a friendly, merry young man, loved and admired by all who knew him. Midas, the Ugly Stranger. In due time, Gordias died, and Midas succeeded him as king. His life was simple but elegant. Most of Midas's time and money, Phrygia was not an especially rich kingdom, had been lavished on a magnificent rose garden in the palace grounds, one of the wonders of the age. Midas loved nothing more than to roam this paradise of colour and fragrance and tend to his plants, each one of which bore 60 glorious blossoms. One morning, as he wandered the garden, noting with habitual delight how exquisitely the beads of dew twinkled on the delicate petals of his darling roses, he tripped over the slumbering form of an ugly, pot-bellied old man curled up on the ground and snoring like a pig. "Oh," said Midas, "I'm so sorry, I didn't see you there." With a belch and a hiccup, the old man rose to his feet and bowed low.
"Beg pardon," he said. "Couldn't help but be drawn by the sweet scent of your roses last night. Fell asleep."
"Not at all," said Midas politely. He had been brought up always to show respect for his elders. "But why don't you come into the palace and partake of some breakfast?"
"Don't mind if I do. Handsome of you."
Midas had no way of knowing that this ugly, pot-bellied old man was Silenus, boon companion of the wine god Dionysus. "Perhaps you would like a bath," he suggested, as they made their way indoors.
"What for?"
"Oh, nothing, just a thought." Silenus stayed for 10 days and 10 nights, making deep inroads into Midas's meagre cellar, but rewarding him with outrageous songs, dances, and stories. On the 10th night, Silenus announced that he would be leaving the next morning.
"My master will be pining for me," he said. "Don't suppose your people could conduct me to him, could they?"
"With pleasure," said Midas. The next day, Midas and his retinue led Silenus on the long journey to the southern vineyards that Dionysus liked to frequent at that time of year. After many hours of struggling through the heat and tangle of choked lanes, steep hills, and narrow byways, they came upon the wine god and his attendants picnicking in a field. Dionysus was overjoyed to see his old friend.
"Wine tastes sour without you," he said. "Dances go wrong and music falls flat on the ears. Where have you been?"
"I got lost," said Silenus. "This kind fellow," he pushed the reluctant Midas forward to face the god, "took me into his palace and gave me the run of the place. I drank most of his wine, ate most of his food, pissed in his water jars and sicked up over his silk cushions. Never complained. Thoroughly good soul."
Silenus slapped Midas on the back. Midas smiled as best he could. He hadn't known about the water jars and the silk cushions. Dionysus, like many deep drinkers, could easily become very emotional and affectionate. He pawed gratefully at Midas.
"You see,"
he declared to the world in general. You see? Just when you lose faith in humanity, they show their worth like this. This is what my father means by Xenia. Makes my heart burst. Name it. Excuse me? Midas was keen to leave. 10 days and nights of Silenus had been quite enough. He yearned now to be alone with his flowers. A drunken Dionysus with a full entourage of maenads and satyrs might just be too much even for his patience. Name your reward. Anything. Whatever you desire, I will providedly divine. Which is to say, Dionysus amended with dignity, I will divinely provide. So there, he added belligerently, turning suddenly round to face off no one in particular. You mean, my lord, that I can ask anything of you? Which of us has not entertained joyous fantasies of genies and fairies granting us wishes? I am sorry to say that at this offer from Dionysus, Midas had rather a rush of blood to the head. I've mentioned that Phrygia was one of the poorer kingdoms, and while Midas was not considered by his friends to be rapacious or avaricious, he did long, like any ruler, for more money to spend on his armies, his palace, his subjects, and his municipal amenities. The expenses of a royal household mount up, and Midas had always been too benevolent a king to burden his people with heavy taxes. And so he found a most extraordinary wish making its way from his fevered brain to his mouth. Then I ask this, he said, that everything I touch be turned to gold. Dionysus smiled a rather diabolical smile. Really? That's what you want? That is what I want. Go home, said the god. Bathe yourself in wine and go to bed. When you arise in the morning, your wish will be granted. Goldfinger. It is probable that Midas did not believe that anything would come of this exchange. The gods were notorious for dodging, twisting, and sliding out of their obligations. Nevertheless, just in case, after all, what harm could it do? I mean, one never knows. That night, Midas poured a few hogsheads from his diminishing store of wine into the royal bath. The fumes from it ensured that when he went to bed, he enjoyed a deep and untroubled sleep. He awoke to a sparkling morning that cast all ideas of wild wishes and drunken gods from his mind. With thoughts only for his flowers, he sprang from bed and hurried to his beloved garden. Never had the roses looked more beautiful. He leant down and sniffed a pink young hybrid that was in that perfect state midway between bud and full bloom. The exquisite fragrance made him giddy with joy. He lovingly made to unfurl the petals. In an instant, the stem and flower had been transformed into gold, solid gold. Midas stared in disbelief. He touched another rose, and then another. The moment his fingers touched them, they turned to gold. He ran up and down the garden in a whooping frenzy, brushing his hands along the bushes until every one had been frozen into hard, shining, precious, priceless, glorious, golden gold. Skipping and shouting with joy, Midas beheld what had once been a garden of rare roses and was now the most valuable treasure in all the world. He was rich. He was insanely, monumentally rich. No man on earth had ever been richer. The sound of his exultant shouts attracted his wife, who came out of the palace doors and stood looking down, their infant daughter in her arms. "Darling, why are you shouting?" Midas ran up to her and encircled mother and child in a tight hug of excited joy. "You won't believe it," he said. "Everything I touch turns to gold. Look, all I have to do is..." Oh. He stepped back to see that his wife and infant girl were now one fused golden statue glittering in the morning sun, a frozen mother and child group that any sculptor would have been proud of. "I'll attend to that later," Midas said to himself. "There must be a way to recover them. Dionysus wouldn't be so. Meanwhile, zim zam zoo! A guard on sentry, the great side door to the palace, and his favourite throne were now entirely gold. Vim vam voo! The side table, his goblet, his cutlery, solid gold. But what was this? Crack! His teeth almost broke on a hard golden peach. Tunk! His lips met metallic wine. Thwop! A heavy gold nugget that had once been a linen napkin crushed and bruised his lips. The unbounded delight began to fade as Midas realized the full import of his gift. You may imagine the rest. All at once, the thrill and pleasure of his ownership of gold were changed to dread and fear. All Midas touched turned to gold, but his heart turned to lead. No words of his, no shrieks of imprecation to the heavens, could return his cold, solidified wife and daughter to quick, warm life. The sight of his beloved roses dropping their heavy heads caused his own to bow in misery. Everything around him glinted and glittered, gleamed and glimmered with a gorgeous, gaudy, golden glow, but his heart was as grim and grey as granite. And the hunger and thirst! After 3 days of food and drink, turning to inedible gold the moment it touched him, Midas felt ready for death. Atop his golden bed, whose hard, heavy sheets offered no warmth or comfort, he fell into a fevered sleep. He dreamed of his flowers blooming back into soft, delicate life. His roses, yes, but most of all, the flowers that he now understood mattered most, his wife and child. In the wild, contorted dream, he saw the soft colours returning to their cheeks and the light shining once more in their eyes. As these beguiling images danced and flickered in his mind, the voice of Dionysus boomed inside him. "Foolish man! It is fortunate for you that Silenus is so fond of you. Only for his sake do I show you mercy. When you awaken in the morning, betake yourself to the river Pactolus, plunge your hands in its waters, and your enchantment will be dissolved. Whatever you wash in the fast-flowing stream will be restored to you." The next morning, Midas did what the voice in his dream had instructed. As promised, contact with the waters of the river relieved him of his golden touch. Mad with joy, he spent a good week shuttling back and forth, immersing his wife, his daughter, his guards, servants, roses, and all of his possessions in the river, and clapping his hands in delight as they returned to their valueless but priceless original state. After this, the waters of the Pactolus that wind around the foothills of Mount Tmolus became the single greatest source of electrum, a natural alloy of gold and silver in all the Aegean. King Midas's ears. You would think that Midas had learned his lesson by now. The lesson that repeats and repeats throughout the story of man. Don't mess with the gods. Don't trust the gods. Don't anger the gods. Don't barter with the gods. Don't compete with the gods. Leave the gods well alone. Treat all blessings as a curse and all promises as a trap. Above all, never insult a god. Ever. In one respect, Midas had certainly changed. He now spurned not just gold, but all riches and possessions. Shortly after Dionysus lifted the curse, he became a devoted follower of Pan, the goat-footed god of nature, fauns, meadows, and all the wild things of the world. With flowers in his hair, sandals on his feet, and the merest suggestion of clothing covering his modesty, Midas left his wife and daughter in charge of Phrygia and devoted himself to a hippy-happy life of simple bucolic virtue. All might have been well had not his master Pan taken it into his head to challenge Apollo to a competition to determine which was the superior, the lyre or the pipes. In a meadow one afternoon, before an audience of fauns, satyrs, dryads, nymphs, assorted demigods, and other lesser immortals, Pan put the syrinx to his lips. A coarse but likable air in the Lydian mode emerged. It seemed to summon barking deer, rushing waters, gambolling rabbits, rutting stags, and galloping horses. The rough, rustic tune delighted the audience, especially Midas, who really did worship Pan and all the frolicking mirth and madness that the goatfoot represented. When Apollo stood and sounded the first notes of his lyre, a hush fell. From his strings arose visions of universal love, harmony, and happiness, a deep, abiding joy in life, and a sense of heaven itself. When he had finished, the audience rose as one to applaud. Tmolus, the deity of the mountain, called out, "The lyre of the great lord Apollo wins." All agreed.
"Aye, aye," roared the satyrs and fauns. "Apollo, Apollo," cried the nymphs and dryads.
One lone voice demurred.
"No."
"No?"
Dozens of heads turned to see who could have dared dissent. Midas rose to his feet.
"I disagree. I say the pipes of Pan produce the better sound."
Even Pan was astonished. Apollo quietly put down his lyre and walked towards Midas.
"Say that again."
It could at least be said of Midas that he had the courage of his convictions. He swallowed twice before repeating,
I say the pipes make a better sound. Their music is more exciting, more artistic."
Apollo must have been in a soft mood that day, for he did not slaughter Midas on the spot. He did not peel the skin from him layer by layer, as he had done to Marsyas, when that unfortunate had had the temerity to challenge him. He did not cause Midas even the slightest amount of pain, but just said softly,
"You honestly think Pan played better than me?"
"I do."
"Well, in that case," said Apollo with a laugh, "you must have the ears of an ass."
No sooner were these words out of the god's mouth than Midas felt something strange and warm and rough going on in his scalp. As he put an inquiring hand to his head, howls and hoots and screams and screeches of mocking laughter started to come from the assembled throng. They could see what Midas could not.
two large grey donkey ears had pushed their way through his hair and were twitching and flicking back and forth for all the world to see.
"It seems I was right," said Apollo. "You do indeed have the ears of an ass."
Crimsoning with shame and mortification, Midas turned and fled the meadow, the taunts and jeers of the crowd sounding all the more clearly in his great furry ears. His life as a camp follower of Pan was over. Tying his head in a kind of turban, he returned to his wife and family in the palace of Gordium, and, his carefree experiment in country living decidedly over, settled back down into the life of a king. The only person who saw his ass's ears was necessarily the servant who cut his hair every month. No one else in Phrygia knew the terrible secret, and Midas was determined it should stay that way. "Here's the deal," Midas told the barber. "I give you a bigger salary and a more generous pension than any other member of the palace staff, and you keep quiet about what you have seen. If, however, you breathe a word to anyone, I will slaughter your family before your eyes, cut out your tongue, and leave you to wander the world in mute poverty and exile. Understood?" The frightened barber nodded. For 3 years, each side kept to the bargain. The barber's wife and family waxed fat and happy on the extra money that came in, and no one found out about the king's asinine auditory appendages. Turbans in the Midas style caught on throughout Phrygia, Thrace, Lydia, and beyond. All was well. But secrets are terrible things to have to keep, especially such juicy ones as that to which the royal barber was privy. Every day he would wake up and feel that the knowledge was writhing and swelling inside him. The barber loved his wife and family, and was, in any case, loyal enough to his monarch not to have any wish to humiliate or embarrass him. But that bulging, ballooning secret had to be somehow released before he burst. No unmilked cow with swollen udders, no mother of overdue twins, no gut-stuffed gastronome straining on the privy could ever feel such a desperate need for relief from their agonies than this poor barber. Finally, he hit upon a scheme which he felt sure would rid him of his burden without endangering his family. Awaking from a tortured night in which he dreamed that he had revealed the secret to the gaping populace of Gordium from a balcony in the main square, he went out at first light deep into the remote countryside. In a lonely place by a stream, he dug a deep trench in the ground. Looking about him in all directions to make sure that he was alone and that there was no possibility of being overheard, he knelt down, cupped his hands around his mouth, and shouted these words into the hole: "Midas has ass's ears!" Scrabbling frantically to close up the hole before the words could escape, he failed to notice one tiny seed floating down and settling at the bottom. When the backfilling was done, the barber stamped fiercely up and down on the earth to seal in the dreadful secret. He skipped all the way back to Gordium, headed straight for his favourite tavern, and ordered a flagon of the house's best wine. He could drink now without fear that the wine might loosen his tongue. It was as if he were Atlas, and the sky had finally been lifted from his shoulders. Meanwhile, over the next few weeks, back in the remote field by the stream, that tiny seed, warmed by the soft breath of Gaia below, began to germinate. Soon, a delicate little reed was shouldering its way through the topsoil and pushing its delicate head into the air. As the breeze caught it, the reed softly whispered, "Midas has ass's ears." The faint words reached the rushes and sedges that fringed the riverbank. "Midas has ass's ears." The susurration of rushes and the hiss of sedges was swept on by the grasses and leaves of the trees, and swiftly the soughing of cypresses and sallows sent the sound to the breeze. "Midas has ass's ears," sighed the branches. "Midas has ass's ears," sang the birds. And at last the news reached the city. "Midas has ass's ears!" King Midas woke with a start. There was laughter and shouting in the street outside the palace. He crept to the window, crouched down, and listened. The humiliation was too much for him to bear. Without stopping to wreak his vengeance on the barber and the barber's family, he mixed a poisonous draught of ox blood, raised his eyes heavenwards, gave a bitter laugh and a shrug, drained the drink, and died. Poor Midas. His name will always mean fortunate and rich, but truly he was unlucky and poor, if only he had kept to his roses. Green fingers are better than gold. Afterword. I was lucky enough to have picked up a book called Tales from Ancient Greece when I was quite small. It was Love at First Meeting. Much as I went on to enjoy myths and legends from other cultures and peoples, there was something about these Greek stories that lit me up inside. The energy, humour, passion, particularity and believable detail of the world held me enthralled from the very first. I hope they will do the same for you. Perhaps you already know some of the myths told here, but I especially welcome those who may never have encountered the characters and stories of Greek myth before. You don't need to know anything to listen to this book. It starts with an empty universe. Certainly no classical education is called for, no knowledge of the difference between nectar and nymphs, satyrs and centaurs, or the fates and the furies is required. There is absolutely nothing academic or intellectual about Greek mythology. It is addictive, entertaining, approachable, and astonishingly human. But where did they come from, these myths of ancient Greece? In the tangle of human history, we may be able to pull on a single Greek thread and follow it back, but by picking out only one civilization and its stories, we might be thought of as taking liberties with the true source of universal myth. Early human beings the world over wondered at the sources of power that fueled volcanoes, thunderstorms, tidal waves, and earthquakes. They celebrated and venerated the rhythm of the seasons, the procession of heavenly bodies in the night sky, and the daily miracle of the sunrise. They questioned how it might all have started. The collective unconscious of many civilizations has told stories of angry gods, dying and renewing gods, fertility goddesses, deities, demons, and spirits of fire, earth, and water. Of course, the Greeks were not the only people to weave a tapestry of legends and lore out of the puzzling fabric of existence. The gods of Greece, if we are archaeological and paleoanthropological about it all, can be traced back to the sky fathers, moon goddesses, and demons of the fertile crescent of Mesopotamia, today's Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. The Babylonians, Sumerians, Akkadians, and other civilizations there, which first flourished far earlier than the Greeks, had their creation stories and folk myths, which, like the languages that expressed them, could find ancestry in India and thence back westwards to prehistory, Africa, and the birth of our species. But whenever we tell any story, we have to snip the narrative string somewhere to make a starting point. It is easy to do this with Greek mythology because it has survived with a detail, richness, life, and colour that distinguishes it from other mythologies. It was captured and preserved by the very first poets and has come down to us in an unbroken line from the beginning of writing to the present day. While Greek myths have much in common with Chinese, Iranian, Indian, Mayan, African, Russian, Native American, Hebrew, and Norse myths, they are uniquely, as the writer and mythographer Edith Hamilton put it, the creation of great poets. The Greeks were the first people to make coherent narratives, a literature even, of their gods, monsters, and heroes. The arc of the myths follows the rise of mankind, our battle to free ourselves from the interference of the gods, their abuse, their meddling, their tyranny over human life and civilization. Greeks did not grovel before their gods. They were aware of their vain need to be supplicated and venerated, but they believed humans were their equal. Their myths understand that whoever created this baffling world with its cruelties, wonders, caprices, beauties, madness, and injustice must themselves have been cruel, wonderful, capricious, beautiful, mad, and unjust. The Greeks created gods that were in their image, warlike but creative, wise but ferocious, loving but jealous, tender but brutal, compassionate but vengeful. Mythos begins at the beginning but does not end at the end. Had I included heroes like Oedipus, Perseus, Theseus, Jason, and Heracles, and the details of the Trojan War, the book would have been too heavy even for a Titan to pick up, or too long for an immortal to listen to. I'm only concerned here with telling the stories, not with explaining them or investigating the human truths and psychological insights that may lie behind them. The myths are fascinating enough in all their disturbing, surprising, romantic, comic, tragic, violent, and enchanting detail to stand on their own as stories. If, as you read, you cannot help wondering what inspired the Greeks to invent a world so rich and detailed in character and incident, and you find yourself pondering the deep truths that the myths embody, well, that is certainly part of the pleasure. And pleasure is what immersing yourself in the world of Greek myth is all about. I have assembled below a few thoughts on the nature of myth and a brief outline of some of the sources I've had recourse to in the writing of this book. I cannot repeat too often that it has never been my aim to interpret or explain the myths, only to tell them. I have, of course, had to play about with timelines in order to attempt a coherent narrative. My version of the ages of man varies from that of Hesiod, for example, in order more clearly to separate the eras of the rule of Kronos and the creation of man. So energetic was the explosion of stories that came from Greece 3,000 years ago that necessarily all sorts of events seemed to happen at once. If anyone tells me that I've got the stories wrong, I believe I'm justified in replying that they are, after all, fictions. In tinkering with the details, I am doing what people have always done with myths. In that sense, I feel that I'm doing my bit to keep them alive. Myth versus legend versus religion. Much as a pearl is formed around grit, so a legend is taken to have been built up around a grain of truth. The legend of Robin Hood, for example, seems to have derived from a real historical figure, Robin of Locksley, the Earl of Huntingdon, and Lord Fitzooth are popular candidates. The narrative substance that accretes as the story is handed down over the generations, embellished and exaggerated on the way, at some point takes on the properties of legend. It is likely to be written down, for the word derives from the Latin gerundive of legere, meaning to be read. Interestingly, the absolute origin of the verb legere and its supine form lectum bears the meaning of to gather, as in college and collect. So maybe legends are as much to do with stories that are collected as with those that are written down and read. Myths, however, are imaginative symbolic constructs. No one believes that Hephaestus ever truly existed. He stands as a representation of the arts of metalwork, manufacture, and craftsmanship. That such a figuration is portrayed as swarthy, ugly, and hobbled tempts us to interpret and explain. Perhaps we noticed that real blacksmiths, while strong, are often dark, scarred, and so muscle-bound as to be bunched and alarming to look upon. Perhaps cultures required that the fit, tall, and whole be always taken into the ranks of fighting men, and that from the first the halt, lame, and shorter male children might be trained in the forges and workshops rather than drilled for battle. Any god of blacksmiths that the collective culture imagined, therefore, would be likely to reflect the human archetype they already knew. Gods of this kind are created in our image, not the other way round. Symbolical rather than historical in origin, as myths and mythical figures might be, they underwent the same fictional remodelling and embellishments as more factually rooted legends. They, too, were written down, and the Greek myths especially, thanks to Homer, Hesiod, and those that followed, were chronicled and detailed in ways that have granted us the timelines, genealogies, and character histories that allow for storytelling of the kind I have attempted with this book. Myths, to put it simply and obviously, deal with gods and monsters that can't be observed or pointed at. It may be that some members of the ancient Greek population believed in centaurs and water dragons, gods of the sea and goddesses of the hearth, but they would have a hard time proving their existence and convincing others. Most of those who told and retold the myths would have been aware, I think, at some level of their consciousness, that they were telling fictional tales. They might have thought the world was once peopled with nymphs and monsters, but they could be fairly certain that such beings no longer existed. Prayer, obedience, and sacrifice, the taxation paid to the invisible forces of nature, that is a different thing. At some point, myth becomes cult, becomes religion. It moves from stories told around the fire to a systematized set of beliefs to which allegiance is owed. Priestly castes arose who ordained how people should behave. How myths become codified into scriptures, liturgies, and theologies is a subject for another book and quite beyond my scope. We can say the Greeks had no written, revealed texts akin to the Bible or the Quran. There were mysteries and initiations of various kinds that involved ecstatic states, perhaps not unlike the shamanic ones seen today in other parts of the world, and there were plenty of temples and shrines. It is true that even in the great Athenian age of reason and philosophy, a man like Socrates could be executed for religious reasons. He was accused of an irreligious refusal to recognize the Athenian state's gods. The Greeks. It is always a mistake to think of the Greeks as being superior humans, uniquely endowed with enlightened wisdom and rational benevolence. We would find much in ancient Greece alien and distasteful to us. Women could play no real part in affairs outside the home. Slavery was endemic, punishments were harsh, and life could be brutal. Dionysus and Ares were their gods, quite as much as Apollo and Athena. Pan, Priapus and Poseidon, too. What makes them so appealing to us is that they seem to be so subtly, insightfully and animatedly aware of these different sides to their natures. Know thyself was carved into the entablature of the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. As a people, if we read them through the myths as much as in their other writings, they did their best to attend to that ancient maxim. So while they may have been far from perfect, the ancient Greeks seem to have developed the art of seeing life, the world, and themselves with greater candor and unclouded clarity than is managed by most civilizations, including perhaps our own. Location, location. Greece. What and where is that? It was no kind of a nation at the time of the myths. There is a politically identifiable sovereign landmass and collection of islands we can now visit, but the Greek world of mythos includes much of Asia Minor, incorporating Turkey, parts of Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, as well as areas of North Africa, Egypt, the Balkans, Albania, Croatia, and Macedonia. The story of Arion and the dolphin takes us to southern Italy, and other myths deal with people who might at times have called themselves Hellenic, Ionian, Argive, Attic, Thracian, Aeolian, Spartan, Doric, Athenian, Cypriot, Corinthian, Theban, Phrygian, Sicilian, Cretan, Trojan, Boeotian, Lydian, and much more besides. It is all, I am well aware, confusing and probably irritating to anyone but a scholar or a Greek citizen. I really hope you don't bust a boiler trying to work it all out. Goodness knows I bust mine often enough, and I wouldn't wish the same confusion and worry on you. Sources ancient. To retell Greek mythical stories is to tread in the footsteps of giants. I have already shared Edith Hamilton's observation that Greek myth is the creation of great poets. While its deepest origins lie in prehistory and unrecorded folklore, in preparing material for this book, I have been able, as any one of us can, to consult the very first poets of the Western tradition who just happened to be Greek, and whose subject matter just happened to be myth. There is a unique treasury of extant sources that chart the chronology of Greek myth from the creation of the universe and birth of the gods, all the way to the end of their interaction and interference in human affairs. It begins with Homer, who may or may not have been a single blind Ionian bard, but whose name is attached to the two great epic poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, that were put together sometime, it is thought, in the 8th century BC. Their setting is the siege of Troy and its aftermath, but Homer makes countless useful references back to earlier myths. His approximate contemporary, the poet Hesiod, most certainly an individual, did the most to create what might be called a timeline for Greek mythology. His Theogony narrates the creation, the rise of the Titans, the birth of the gods, and the establishment of Olympus. His Works and Days tells the great human creation stories of Prometheus and Pandora, as well as laying out mankind's five ages: golden, silver, bronze, heroic, and iron. Other Greek and subsequent Roman poets, writers, and travellers filled in gaps, elaborated, embroidered, fused, confused, and just plain fabricated Greek mythical stories that mostly descended from Hesiod's genealogical plan. Of these, the Bibliotheca, a great dictionary of myth from the 2nd century BC, is perhaps the most valuable source. It was originally thought to have been the work of Apollodorus of Athens, 180 BC, but this is now doubted, so the work is attributed these days to an unknown who goes by the demeaning sobriquet of Pseudo-Apollodorus. Other compelling and/or reliable sources include the Greek traveller and guidebook compiler Pausanias and Latin poets, historians and novelists Longus, Apuleius and Hyginus. Towering above them all is the Roman poet Ovid, whose Metamorphoses or Transformations tells of those mortals, nymphs and others who were changed by the gods into animals, plants, rivers or even stones, as a punishment or out of pity. His other works, principally Ars Amatoria, the Art of Love, and Heroides, the Heroines, also contain recastings of Greek myth, using always the Latin names for the gods, Jove or Jupiter for Zeus, Diana for Artemis, Cupid or Amor for Eros, and so on. Ovid is prolific, profuse, irreverent, saucy, and cinematic in his energy and restless switching of points of view. It is clear from the wealth of references in his plays and poems that Shakespeare, among many other writers and artists, was hugely influenced by him. Ovid was happy to add, subtract, and invent, and this has influenced and emboldened me to be, shall we say, imaginative? In some of my retellings, too. Sources modern. Many children on both sides of the Atlantic grew up, as I did, on classic collections of the Greek myths by four enduringly popular Americans. Two were 19th century writers, Nathaniel Hawthorne, who gave us A Wonder Book for Boys and Girls and its sequel Tanglewood Tales, and his contemporary, Thomas Bulfinch, whose compendious Bulfinch's Mythology has run through dozens and dozens of editions in its 150 years of life. The 20th century was dominated by the matchless Edith Hamilton's Mythology, Timeless Tales of Gods and Heroes, which is still happily in print, and by Bernard Evslin's evergreen Heroes, Gods and Monsters of the Greek Myths. British equivalents included Charles and Mary Lamb's The Adventures of Ulysses and L.S. Hyde's Favourite Greek Myths, this last being a great favourite of mine when I was a boy. Estimable as all of these were and still are, they tend shyly to skirt round or bowdlerise the erotic and violent episodes that form such an essential part of the Greek mythic world. The poet and novelist Robert Graves had no such compunctions, but his two eccentrically structured and narrated volumes of The Greek Myths, while meticulous, scholarly and inspiring, chart a more literary and mythographical course, often with a view to highlighting his obsession with cults of the White Goddess. The approach of James Frazer and those who came after, including Joseph Campbell, valuable as they are, also have other, more general, academic, psychological, comparative, and anthropological fish to fry. Online these days, there are plenty of sites devoted to helping the young find Greek myth, though you may feel like a lie-down after reading those that describe Cadmus as a homie, Hermes as cool, and Hades as a dude with issues. Appendix 1. The Brothers, a sidebar. A word about Epimetheus and Prometheus. They were the sons of Clymene, Asia, and Iapetus, making them the younger brothers of sky-shouldering Atlas and thunderbolt-exploded Menoetius. It is generally held that Prometheus means forethought and Epimetheus afterthought, from which it is usually inferred that Epimetheus blundered into things without considering consequences, while his elder, Prometheus, deliberated with more perspicacity. It might be convincingly argued that there was nothing especially cautious, forward-thinking, or prescient about Prometheus's actions in bringing fire to man. It was impulsive, generous, loving even, but not especially wise. Epimetheus was a kindly, well-disposed individual also, and his failings were only, I was going to say human, but that can hardly be right, for he was a titan. His failings were certainly titanic in their consequences. The perceived difference between the brothers is used to this day by philosophers to express something fundamental about us all. In Plato's dialogue Protagoras, the title character suggests a creation myth somewhat different from the traditionally accepted one. At one time, so Protagoras tells Socrates, there being only immortals in the world, the gods decided to populate nature with new strains of mortal life. Out of earth and water, and with divine fire and divine breath, they created animals and man. They charged Prometheus and Epimetheus with the task of allocating to these creatures all the attributes and characteristics that would enable them to live fulfilled and successful lives. Epimetheus said he would do the distributing, and Prometheus could come and check up on his work. This the brothers agreed upon. Epimetheus set to with a will. He gave armor to some animals, the rhinoceros, the pangolin, and the armadillo, for instance. To others, almost at random it seemed, he handed out heavy weatherproof fur, camouflage, venom, feathers, tusks, talons, scales, claws, gills, wings, whiskers, and goodness knows what else. He assigned speed and ferocity. He apportioned buoyancy and airworthiness. Every animal was fitted out with its own cleverly designed and efficient speciality. From navigational skills to expertise in burrowing, nest building, swimming, leaping, and singing. Epimetheus was just congratulating himself for providing the bats and dolphins with echolocation when he realized that this had been the very last of the available gifts. He had, with his characteristic lack of foresight, completely omitted to consider what he would parcel out to man. Poor, naked, vulnerable, smooth-skinned, two-legged man. Epimetheus went guiltily to his brother and asked what they should do now that there was nothing left in the bottom of the gift basket. Man had no defences with which to arm himself for the cruelty, cunning, and rapacity of these now superbly provisioned animals. The very powers that had been lavished on the beasts would surely finish off weaponless mankind. Prometheus's solution was to steal the arts from Athena and flame from Hephaestus. With these, man could use wisdom, wit, and industry to pit himself against the animals. He may not swim as well as a fish, but he could work out how to build boats. He may not run as swiftly as a horse, but he could learn to tame, shoe, and ride one. One day he may even construct wings to rival those of the birds. Somehow, by accident and error then, alone of all mortal creatures, man was given qualities from Olympus, not so that he could rival the gods, but so he could fend off the more perfectly equipped animals. Appendix 2. Hope. What Elpis, being left behind in Pandora's jar, meant to the Greeks, and what it might mean for us today, has been a matter of intriguing debate among scholars and thinkers since the invention of writing, and perhaps even before that. For some, it reinforces the terrible nature of Zeus's curse on man. All the ills of the world were sent to plague us, they argue, and we were denied even the consolation of hope. The abandoning of hope, after all, is often used as a phrase that preludes the end to caring or striving. Dante's Gates of Hell commanded all who entered there entirely to abandon it. How terrible then to believe that hope might abandon us. Others have maintained that Elpis means more than hope. It suggests expectation, and not only that, but expectation of the worst. Foreboding, in other words, dread, an impending sense of doom. This interpretation of the Pandora myth submits that the final fairy locked in the jar was, in fact, the most evil of them all, and that without it, man is at least denied a presentiment of the awfulness of his own fate and the meaningless cruelty of existence. With Elpis locked away, in other words, we are, like Epimetheus, capable of living from day to day, blithely ignorant of, or at least ignoring, the shadow of pain, death, and ultimate failure that looms over us all. Their interpretation of the myth is, in a dark manner, optimistic. Nietzsche looked at it in yet another, slightly different way. For him, hope was the most pernicious of all the creatures in the jar because hope prolongs the agony of man's existence. Zeus had included it in the jar because he wanted it to escape and torment mankind every day with the false promise of something good to come. Pandora's imprisonment of it was a triumphant act that saved us from Zeus's worst cruelty. With hope, Nietzsche argues, we are foolish enough to believe there is a point to existence, an end, and a promise. Without it, we can at least try to get on and live free of delusional aspiration. Hopefully, or hopelessly, we can decide for ourselves. Appendix 3. Giant Leaps. There are some stories of a gigantomachy, or war with the giants. 100 of this warrior race, who, as I have mentioned, were not especially tall or gigantic in the modern sense, were born of Gaia and the blood of the gelded Uranus. It may be that the war was Gaia's last attempt at wresting control of the cosmos. In some sources, there seems to be an overlap or fusion with the Titanomachy. What seems certain is that a violent uprising of some sort did take place, and that it was led by the king of the giants, Eurymedon, against the gods. We do not have the names of all the participants, but the fates of a few of the leaders, including Enceladus, the noisy one, Porphyrion, the purple one, and Polybotes, my Greek-English lexicon isn't of much help here, the name seems to mean much nourishing or many feeding, fertile, perhaps. These were certainly recorded. Polybotes was crushed under Nisyrus, a section of the island of Kos that Poseidon broke off and thrust on top of him. Enceladus was buried by Athena under Mount Etna, from which prison he continues to grumble volcanically. Scientists now tell us that the moon of Saturn, named after Enceladus, a mere 800 million miles from Earth, appears to offer the necessary conditions for life. So perhaps all along Gaia had laid plans for the expansion of her bloodline on other worlds. I have read of another giant called Aristaeus, the best, not to be confused with a minor god of beekeeping with the same name, who was spared from the war by being hidden away in the shape of a dung beetle by his mother Gaia. The giant Damisus, the conqueror, was killed early in the struggle, but came to fame later when his body was exhumed by Chiron for spare parts. As for the others, Hephaestus emptied a vat of molten iron all over the unfortunate Mimas. Clytius was consumed in the flames of Hecate's torches. Cisseus, with Zeus in hot pursuit, was saved from extinction when Gaia turned him into a fig tree, and Hippolytus was slain by Hermes, who cheated by wearing his invisibility cloak. We know that Dionysus killed Typhoeus, but Thoon, Phoetios, Molios, Amphitos, and, goodness knows how many others of the giant race, all met their ends in ways which went, so far as we know, unrecorded. The giant Porphyrion, in one account, in the act of trying to rape Hera, was killed by Zeus and Hercules, which places him much later in the timeline than the Titanomachy, as if so consistent and stable a device as a timeline could ever be used to delineate the complex, kaleidoscopic, and disorderly unfolding of Greek myth.
This has been a Chronicle Books production of Mythos, The Greek Myths Retold, written and read by Stephen Fry. Mythos is available in print and as an ebook from Chronicle Books. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by Stephen Fry. Audio production copyright 2019 Chronicle Books. All rights reserved. Chronicle Books supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact rights@chroniclebooks.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.